From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells.
Today we speak with ethnobotanist and writer Dr. Cassandra Leah Quave. She'll show us the fascinating world of plants as medicine. Now, plants are a basis for an array of life-saving and health-improving medicines we all now take for granted. Her new book is called The Plant Hunter, A Scientist's Quest for Nature's Next Medicines.
Then our second guest, archaeologist and wilderness survivor, instructor Chris Begley. In an era of pandemics, climate change, and political unrest, it's all too easy to envision doomsday scenarios. In Chris's new book, The Next Apocalypse, he turns to history, specifically the Maya, the Roman Empire, and the Native American societies, to show what happens when civilizations undergo radical change and disappear, and what this can teach us about our own potentially disastrous future.
Have you ever heard of this, an ethnobotanist? Well, that is what our next guest, Dr. Cassandra Leah Quave, is. She's written a new book called The Plant Hunter, A Scientist's Quest for Nature's Next Medicine. So, have you ever taken an aspirin? Well, as a lot of us know, you have a willow tree to thank for that. Have you ever received a shot of numbing medication at the dentist's office prior to a procedure? Well, that was originally discovered in a plant too, the cocoa plant from the Andes. Dr. Cassandra Leah Quave joins us to talk about this new book and all of an ethnobotanist's world. Cassandra, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Great. Thanks so much. I'm excited to be here.
It is funny. I don't think I had ever heard of an ethnobotanist. What is that?
Yeah, I hadn't heard of ethnobotany either until almost my senior year of college. Ethnobotany at its most fundamental level is the science of survival. So this is the study of how humans relate to plants and how we use plants for everything from, you know, structure to shelter to food, clothing, art, tools, and in my area of interest, medicine.
I think a lot of us know that a lot of medications we currently take had origins or, you know, its genesis in a plant. But really, how far have we gotten away from this organic, naturally occurring, whatever it was, component plant that got us to this? How many steps or layers removed are we from that now?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are estimates that around 60% of all of our modern pharmaceuticals were actually either based on or derived from natural products. So natural products, of course, can encompass plants. It can include marine organisms, basically any living organism. But when it comes to plants, you know, some of our most essential medicines that are ranked by the World Health Organization as being essential to have in a medical clinic were originally discovered in plants. And the way I like to describe this in its very simple form is think of these plants as the keepers of chemical blueprints. And what scientists are able to do is once we understand what those chemical blueprints are, we can then take that and, you know, make not only replicate that molecule in the laboratory, but also make analogs or derivatives, small structural changes to those core structures. But, you know, nature is an incredible chemist. The things that you can find in plants are things so wild that no synthetic chemist would be able to just dream these up on their own. They're very hard to build in a laboratory.
I can't wait to talk to my brother about this. He was out here in Park City for the first time. We were hiking and he was so excited about the hike. He went up to this aspen and he hugged it. And I'm reading that you are an unabashed tree hugger. And on a trip to Scotland, you hugged a Fortingall yew, which is, well, tell us about that tree.
Yeah, I mean, the yew tree is such a special tree. I mean, we have, an important therapy for cancer, Taxol, that was originally discovered in the Pacific U and then also in the English U. They made advances in producing this at larger levels to distribute it to people that are battling certain forms of cancer. But this particular U is the Fortingall U, is in a tiny village in the rural area of Scotland. And this tree has been estimated to be, you know, as old as 3,000 to 5,000 years old. And when you think about that, you know, it was around possibly before the time that the pyramids at Giza were built. And there's just something, I think, amazing about the opportunity to touch a creature that's been on this earth for so long. I've also hugged the cedars of Lebanon. I've hugged trees in the Amazon. I don't know. I mean, I guess it sounds a little bit kooky, but I love that connection to nature, and then and just the taking the chance to really reflect on the incredible history that some of these plants have had.
I don't think it's kooky at all, and I've hugged trees as well, and I think there is a great connection. And when you talk about plant biology giving us the opportunity to understand their blueprint of how they're made up, what fascinates me is that with big data today, the ability to be able to get massive amounts of data fairly inexpensively and to write algorithms to be able to go into these blueprints and to be able to maybe ascertain how a particular biology would play with a certain human condition that might be a type of disease or something, I think the opportunities are possibly going to really open up with our ability to be able to figure some of this stuff out. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, I'm of the same mindset. I mean, I think this century is one that's really going to make, you know, we're going to have huge advances in the science of understanding the language of plants, the language of nature. The challenges, of course, with AI is first we have to fuel those algorithms, those databases with chemical data. And so that requires working with the plants themselves because, you know, in a single plant tissue, you might have hundreds of unique molecules. And deriving structures from those molecules is no easy task. It's incredibly difficult. But we've had advances in analytical chemistry as well, even over the past 30 years, where we're able to detect exact masses of compounds available in very tiny amounts. I'm personally really excited about the potential future for looking at microcrystals of these plant compounds through techniques like cryo-electron microscopy, micro-ED, which will allow us to get more structural data on these. So I think absolutely this combination of advances in mass spec, cryo-EM, micro-ED, NMR, single crystal X-ray diffraction can be, you know, really, really important and will be important in fueling these platforms in the future as we mine this chemistry.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Dr. Cassandra Leah Quave about her new book, The Plant Hunter, A Scientist's Quest for Nature's Next Medicines. Cassandra, we could have a conversation just about your bio. That I just have to read a little bit of it here because it's very tied into what you're talking about in the book. You're the herbarium curator and an associate professor of dermatology and human health at Emory University, also the co-founder and CEO of Phytotech. It's a drug discovery company that's dedicated to developing solutions from botanicals for the treatment of recalcitrant antibiotic-resistant infections. And also, you are a fellow of the Explorers Club, which is a highly sought after and a very respected post that you have. And it's really amazing. This book, The Plant Hunter, is partially, it's sort of memoir as well, talking about how you came into this world and then how it's taken you to all reaches of the earth. Tell us a little bit about your personal story and disability.
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. It is memoir. I've been calling it a science memoir, or the memoir of a scientist, I guess, is the way to, you know, a memoir of a scientist that also happens to be a woman in a very male-dominated space, a disabled woman, and also a mother and a wife. And so I wear many hats in my life. And, you know, my journey has, I think, been a bit unusual. I was embedded within systems of medicine from a very young age. You know, I was born with multiple congenital deformities of my skeletal system, which included missing bones in my legs. Some of the bones I did have were very short and underdeveloped. And I had to have scores of surgeries throughout my childhood. So I was in the hospital, in and out of the hospital constantly as I was growing up. First with an amputation that unfortunately led to a life-threatening infection with staph infection that, you know, thankfully was in the 1980s before MRSA was so widespread. And I survived that infection with the use of antibiotics. Had that happened today, I don't know. I don't know if I would have made it. And that's one of the things that really drives me in the work that I do, looking for solutions to treat these really aggressive infectious diseases.
It leads me into this next question, that you feel like we have to return to the plant world to help us surmount this fight, which you call the greatest medical challenge of the century, antibiotic resistant microbes. And you've just said you don't know if you had the same staph infection today that you would make it through it, because I'm assuming of our resistance now to antibiotics.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a real challenge. I mean, antimicrobial resistance today kills around 700,000 people across the globe. By the year 2050, it's projected to kill 10 million a year. That's five times the number of people that died to the horrific COVID-19 in the first year of the pandemic. So, I mean, this threat is coming. It's here. You know, we've only been in the antibiotic era for under a century. When I think about medicine and I think about science, I like to take the long view. I like to look back at the history of medicine because there's so much wisdom we can glean from looking to the past. And, you know, while the discovery of antibiotics was game-changing, it's probably one of the game-changing moments in medicine, aside from, you know, when we finally understood that germs, that microscopic creatures could cause disease, you know, with germ theory. I mean, this is a major advance in our understanding of medicine and our ability to treat infection, but we're losing that battle. And at the same time, there are some pretty bad odds from the economic perspective for developing antibiotics. The economic model is really broken. And I'm not an economist. I don't have the solutions for that. But what I can do and what I'm trying to do is really to help in filling that pipeline with new potential solutions to manage these infections. And there's so much we can learn from other cultures. You know, working with healers, I've come to really appreciate that we don't always need to kill everything to kill these bacteria. Instead, we can use therapies that perhaps weaken the bacteria to the point that your immune system is able to take them out, or weaken them to the point where they're more defenseless, or they're not able to cause as much damage to the body. And so there's a lot, I think, that can be learned by taking an interdisciplinary perspective to this problem.
So there's some things that we know about plants that are informing us and helping us today, but also stories have not been told. When antibiotics came out 100 years ago, people stopped telling the stories of how this particular plant may help with an ailment or those sorts of things. Is there a lot there, you think, that people have used in the past that we're not aware of today?
Absolutely. I mean, I think especially in the United States, there's been a huge breakdown in traditional knowledge transmission. I mean, not just with medicine. Most people, I teach classes on food and health, and it's amazing that I can teach the science to my students and they want to do more with growing their own food or cooking, even learning to cook. Like, so many of them have no idea how to do like the most basic things in the garden or how to cook a meal. I mean, that's knowledge also that's passed down from generation to generation. And we've become so very dissociated from nature and from working, you know, with wild resources or even cultivated resources, there's been a huge breakdown. At the same time, you know, in many parts of the world, there are in fact billions of people that rely on wild natural resources, especially plants, for their primary form of medicine, not as some supplement to their diet, not as, you know, some occasional integrative therapy. Like, that's their medicine. And so I think we also owe it to the global population, not just for looking to plants for the search for new drugs, but also to, you know, inform how these plants work, to understand, do they work? Are they safe? What are the compounds responsible for those activities? And how can we then disseminate both this information to people that use these plants and think about ways to make these innovations accessible to more people?
And where is the work coming from? For an example, is Big Pharma involved in looking at these plant structures and trying to ascertain if there's something there that can help, or are they really just pushing the pharmacology side?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, in the 80s and 90s, pharma was still looking at natural products. I think largely they've abandoned, especially the work on plants. There are some challenges in addition to the scientific hurdles of actually isolating these compounds from these very complex mixtures or identifying their structures, which we talked about earlier. Some of the other challenges are now with new interpretations of patent law, you can no longer claim a patent on the composition of a compound from nature. And so that puts, you know, development at a huge disadvantage. If you don't have a way to protect a molecule that you're working on, because remember, it takes, you know, $800 million to build $1 billion to bring some new drugs to market. I mean, it's not a minor low risk enterprise. It's very costly. And it's a big gamble. And so if you can't protect those molecules or protect the IP on those, that really, I think, really reduces the thirst for looking at those types of molecules. But from a scientific perspective, in my view at least, I think these are the most rational compounds to go after. So we're kind of stuck in this weird chasm of like economic decisions, regulatory decisions. But what I care about is the science. Give me the science. And my hope is that these other things will fall into play in the future because, you know, we're going to need new medicines, whether or not regulations, whether or not patent law agrees with that, we're going to need them. And so we need to be ready.
It's very interesting bringing up this conversation, you know, talking about how maybe Big Pharma is moving away from plants. At the same time, we as consumers are moving towards plants. And I'm thinking of when we're talking about the conversation about cannabis, especially we as consumers wanting to turn away from opioids, which largely Big Pharma has, you know, created the problem for us. So if you're looking at pain management, for example, and you want to turn away, you know, you say, I'm not using opioids at all, I'm going to use cannabis / THC / cannabinoids. I'm not completely fluent on the vocabulary for it, but you see that Big Pharma is sort of trying to get involved in that because realizing that it's a pretty big market. Where do you see that all going?
Yeah, those are great points. I mean, it's a very confusing landscape. We'll just preface it with that. And I'll also preface it with the fact that you're talking about two plant-derived innovations because opioids, of course, derive from opiates from the opium poppy, which has been one of the most important medicinal plants in the history of mankind. Cannabis also has been incredibly important, not just for its psychoactive properties, but also use in fiber. And now, you know, it's being explored for applications in pain. I have some concerns around the regulatory space around cannabis. I mean, there's this, again, this strange gap where me as a scientist who's would like to evaluate the chemical makeup and look at potential safety concerns around especially edible products that are out in the market and also these other, you know, products like Delta 9 that's becoming popular. You know, there are a lot of restrictions on laboratory scientists to be able to even work on these products that people are consuming because of nuances, differences between federal law and state laws. So even in a state where cannabis is legalized, federally it is not legalized. And so as a federally funded institution, if you're an academic research institution, you cannot work on cannabis in your lab without a slew of permits. And even then, you're restricted to certain providers of those cannabis things. So you're not even able really to work on the things that people are consuming, which to me, again, give me the science. The regulatory space is a mess. The laws are a mess right now. We need more science on the safety and efficacy of cannabis. Also, this is not your grandmother's cannabis, right? The strains that are grown today, oh my gosh. I mean, they have such super high levels of THC. And, you know, I think we need a lot more work to understand like what's safe and what's not. And also counterindications for consumption of these with other medicines. So yeah, and in addition to cannabis, I mean, there's been a huge growth in the dietary supplement market, especially during COVID. I mean, sales in the billions of dollars of herbal supplements, because I think we all share this desire to take control of our health, which is a human right in my perspective, that you want to have control of your health. And so people are starting to take more of these in hopes of that. But again, the science isn't always there. There's a lot of marketing hype in many cases, but the science isn't just quite there. And I think we need, as a part of a public duty to people that are consumers, we need to do more to understand the science and safety of these products, because these aren't necessarily the same ways that they're being consumed in traditional medicine. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
It's so interesting that you talk about that. And while we're on kind of the same vein, you know, the whole magic mushroom psilocybin thing for use, you know, from anything mm-hmm. from PTSD to depression, we've done a handful of interviews on this topic. And it is interesting, especially because, well, not you, but John and I grew up in this era of like, you know, oh, LSD is so scary and, you know, all that. And so
the war against drugs.
Yeah, the war against drugs. And so
wasn't that scary?
Yeah. So I don't know. Maybe as a last question, your take on that. And is it just pretty much the same take as you have on the whole THC thing?
I mean, I think that psilocybin berry and mushrooms have played an incredibly important role in traditional systems of medicine. As an entheogen and as a therapeutic tool. I'd love to see more science on this. I'd love to see, you know, and I think that that's growing. I know Johns Hopkins has got some great studies ongoing. I mean, this is so important, as you mentioned, for PTSD, but also for end of life. I mean, I have some colleagues here that work with terminal cancer patients, and coming to peace with your humanity. I mean, if there are tools that are out there in the natural world that we can use to help these patients, my gosh, we have to study this. We have to really, you know, look into that and make these types of therapies available if the science supports it.
We have to button up soon, but I just wanted to put this on the table. Maybe we could talk about this. And that was about 30 years ago or longer, when the FDA came out with something, you know, people understood that, people respected it, and there wasn't a lot of hype because there was no online presence. We didn't have the online community that we have today, where people are out. There's a lot more snake oil salespeople that are pushing different elixirs and things like that. And one of my concerns is when the plant products start coming out and are more evident, that there's so much that the FDA will never be able to keep up with all of this. And there's so much rhetoric out there. I worry about people's safety.
I do too. You know, I mean, I really do. I came out and exposed myself to lots of really, you know, hateful responses from people when I talked about this. But, you know, I was really concerned about some of these COVID cures. I say cure through, you know, in kind of quotation marks, is they, you know, a lot of things that were being purported as natural remedies that actually can be quite deadly and quite dangerous. And I felt a need to speak out for public safety. I think we need to have reliable voices. We need to have the scientific evidence forward and to be really the front line of material to educate the public. And, you know, I hope that readers of this book will gain a better appreciation for that while there is, you know, some marketing hype and there are snake oil salesmen, plants have a lot of value to bring. And there's a lot that we can uncover from them, and hopefully for the betterment of all humanity.
As you say, it's all about the science. Cassandra Leah Quave, it's been such a pleasure talking with you. I think your book is very important. It's called The Plant Hunter, A Scientist's Quest for Nature's Next Medicines. And I just want to mention before we go, too, that you are also the co-founder and co-host, I think, of a podcast called Foodie Pharmacology. So that sounds really interesting. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you both. You guys were fantastic to speak with. Thank you so much
for
having me.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Our next guest is an underwater archaeologist, a wilderness survival instructor, and anthropology professor. Chris Bagley was a Fulbright scholar to El Salvador and is National Geographic Explorer. In short, Chris knows a thing or two about dealing with disasters, emergencies, and the unexpected. Now in his book, The Next Apocalypse, The Art and Science of Survival, Bagley turns to history to examine societies that have disappeared or handled radical change in the past, revealing what they can teach us about our potentially disastrous future. He then goes on to explore the dystopian narratives in pop cultures, what they get wrong, the world of preppers and survivalists, and finally the most likely and unlikely scenarios of a future collapse. Chris Bagley, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, it's good to have you on the program. A fascinating book. And you know, I'll start with this. We certainly have lots of challenges, including the fact that our popular culture just loves all of these disaster movies, books, various films. We have asteroids, earthquakes. We got Mad Max and the Thunderdome. We've got, you know, alien invasions. What is it about our popular culture that wants to continue to feed? I guess there's a demand for it. Is that correct?
Well, I suppose, I mean, there must be, and that very observation was what got me thinking about all of this in the first place. You know, why is it that we like to imagine these scenarios, and what is it about these particular scenarios that somehow have, I don't know, either a cathartic element or something that we like, while at the same time something we fear?
Yeah, and we have a habit of romanticizing some of these things. You know, there's the hero, and if it's, you know, it's just fascinating the way it comes together.
Yeah, one of the things that I saw was that while it was clear that some of these apocalyptic or dystopian narratives grew out of concerns that we had, I mean, we just went through the pandemic, you know, so you have outbreak narratives, you have political collapse, you have environmental collapse, or, you know, events like the super volcanoes. And it struck me that there are a number of disasters, you know, that are just not part of that genre. Nobody really writes about, you know, the aftermath of, well, for instance, the 1918 pandemic. There's very little written about that, and partly that's because of what it took to get through it. And you're absolutely right in noting that we tend to elevate heroes and heroic dramatic action to the forefront. Now, of course, that's what makes a good narrative, so maybe it makes sense if you're making a movie, but when we're thinking about what actually has ever happened, that's not the way it plays out.
Chris, you talk about how, you know, these changes, you know, there's never really this apocalyptic moment that wipes out an entire population. It's all kind of incremental. And again, that's maybe why it's not very dramatic. And certainly, you know, the more we hear about people living in, you know, Miami or New Orleans or these low-lying areas where little by little, you know, people living in basements are experiencing more and more flooding. Again, it is incremental, but how is it that we're sort of missing the point about, you know, any future apocalypse?
Yeah, well, I think part of it has to do with, you know, how we think about the past and how things appear to us. You know, one of the things that occurs when you're an archaeologist looking at the past and you're looking at artifacts, material culture, things people left behind, things can look very dramatic. You know, they're not there and then they are there, or vice versa. And it's hard sometimes to understand the gradual nature of these things. And I think, so to some degree, our vision of what has happened in the past is flawed, and that makes us imagine what might happen in the future in a similarly flawed way. For instance, take the classic Maya collapse, the Central American and culture that in the 9th century really underwent dramatic transformations, including a loss of population in a lot of areas. You know, for a long time, people would say things like, why did the Maya disappear? Of course, there's 7 million Maya living right in the very same spot that these things happened. So we're able to overlook the obvious and, you know, create these scenarios that match up with maybe a mythical past that we have or a future that we'd like to see.
Yeah. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Chris Begley. He's written a new book, The Next Apocalypse. And, you know, Chris, I'm really interested in knowing more about the Mayan culture and you know, we hear so much about how disease wipes out so many people, but maybe, I mean, do we sort of dismiss the story altogether once we say, oh, they were wiped out by disease, and it's a disease that we don't have anymore, so we don't need to look at that? But can you tell us, dive a little deeper into that story?
Well, the you know, if we're talking about disease, probably the best place to look would be, well, what happened all over the Americas with the arrival of Europeans in the 15th, 16th century and beyond. You know, part of our narrative is that, well, they were wiped out and they're not here and we no longer have to worry about it. And that's certainly the kind of narrative you hear in places like Kentucky, where I live, where we not only have these erroneous myths of Kentucky being a hunting ground where people didn't live, to the idea that you know, these were passive victims to these epidemics that passed through, and that really it's all gone. And you know what that gives us license to do, if we believe something like that, is to ignore it. So I think when we look at a lot of these things, we're going to see that you know, there are some you know, convenient stories that we create that help justify all the sorts of things that we've always justified, right? Colonialism, genocide, racism, and so forth.
You know, Chris, what I was curious about 40 years ago, I visited Chichen Itza, which is a Mayan city, abandoned Mayan city. And what struck me immediately was that this civilization knew how to find stone and quarry them. They knew how to cut them. They knew how to fashion them into these beautiful temples. They obviously understood mathematics to be able to do this. And I also heard the story that you know, they didn't know exactly what happened, if it was famine or if it was political problems or warfare and those sorts of things, but they moved. They left that city. They left many of the cities, and they're in Central America. And as you point out in your book, there are many millions of Mayans that still live in Central America. The question that I have is, what happened to, I mean, they were so good at building these temples. What happened? Did the stonemasons not make the journey to the new places?
Yeah, well, I think that you'd have to ask, what do those things represent? You know, this was a group of people that were not only good at making things, and of course making these monuments and the beautiful statues and all that, but also the like you point out, the mathematics, the, you know, the calculation of positions of the stars and planets, not to mention botany, agriculture, all of the local knowledge that you would have to have, plus this incredibly complex cosmological system. And, of course, the Maya also had writing. I mean, true writing in every sense of the word, which we didn't know. We didn't know that that's what we were looking at for a while. So you had this group, and then something happened, obviously, that they were moving out of these cities. And what we see over and over again is that while there might be what we sometimes call a proximate cause, something that starts the ball rolling, it ends up being all of these stressors that make these complex systems collapse. I mean, right now we're dealing with supply chain issues, right? You know, it's the virus didn't create, you know, COVID did not create directly those issues. It puts stress on certain systems, and those put stress on other systems. And finally, things are no longer functional. And so what I would ask would be, why did they stop making these, and why was it not compelling to make them again? What did they represent previously? Because certainly they knew how to do that. They wouldn't have forgotten how to do that. Why did they not do it? And I suspect, as do many others, that what it represents is a particular political system. And when that political system collapsed, you know, you're not making monuments. You're not being directed to make these things. So often when we look at these things, you know, the question is, what was compelling them to do it before? What has changed? They no longer feel compelled to do that.
Well, that seems to make sense. And as we look at, you know, people talk about apocalypses, disasters, things like that. And we certainly have plenty of books and films about this in the popular culture. What do all of these things represent as far as what they've gotten right and what they've gotten wrong about what an apocalypse really looks like?
Yeah. Well, it's a little easier probably to talk about what they've gotten wrong. And I think the big thing that we get wrong all the time, and not just the people creating these narratives, but perhaps all of us. I mean, I know in my sort of imagination, it can go in this direction too. We have an idea that that it will somehow parallel these narratives that we see, where we'll have, you know, a relatively small group, and the type of wilderness skills that I teach in my wilderness survival courses, how to make fire, how to make shelter, how to find direction, and all of those things. While those may certainly help, they can't hurt, and they may be critical for a few days or weeks, that's really not what's going to get us through. You know, the last time that humans on a global scale made a living without farming and distributing those goods was over 3,000 years ago, and there were less than 500 million people on the planet. And so we have, you know, something like 15 times that many people now. We're going to have to work together as in communities to deal with these large-scale needs. And, you know, those are going to require relatively complex systems. And I think that's what we get wrong. And, you know, partly it's understandable. None of that sounds like a very exciting book to me. But it's going to be the kinds of things that we have to do.
Well, I think, Chris, as you are a wilderness survival instructor and you do teach these practical skills, and yet you're coming up against, you know, maybe the survivalists and the preppers in saying that it's not the practical skills we need. It's going to be this political and social structure that we're going to need. We're going to need skills that, you know, maybe are questionable in our society right now, like empathy, fairness, and equity. I'm curious about this rise of, or maybe it's just from my perspective, and maybe it's more in the media, but this whole survivalist and prepper movement, where does that come from?
Well, you know, there's a whole range of people that you'd probably put in that category. So there's going to be some outliers to the kind of thing that I'm talking about. But, you know, I mean, one thing to understand is you know, I mean, we live in a capitalist society, so if you can sell people something, you know, you'll sell it to them. And partly it's a, you know, it's a merchandise based thing. Here's the new gear. Here's the new, you know, a gadget, or here's the new solar system or water system or weapons that are going to keep you safe through this. But I think part of it as well is the fact that, you know, I mean, part of it is what we see in election cycles like 2016, where, you know, Trump is elected in a way that was surprising and probably would have been difficult a decade earlier. Or if we look at other times in history where there's a lot of stress on people, the types of decisions they make are different than they make during times of less stress. So I would say part of this focus is reflecting different stressors on parts of the population, and some of it from the narratives and from the magazines and from the YouTube videos and blog posts that I'll see of these folks. Part of it is our changing society. You know, the different ideas of masculinity, different ideas about race, different ideas about gender, the influx of different people, suddenly having to live in a multicultural setting. I mean, where I am in Lexington, Kentucky, is pretty metropolitan with universities and all of this, but certainly the racial and ethnic makeup of the city's radically changed from, say, 25 years ago. And I think that those changes are part of what propel people into thinking about these situations where maybe things would go back to the way they used to be or the way they imagined that they used to be. And that is, you know, part of this too. And then, of course, there's real and, you know, demonstrable problems like climate change.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit. Well, you introduced climate change, but I was going to ask you something I want to make sure we have time for, because if you, depending on who you talk to or what you're reading, the fall of the Roman Empire was brought about by any number of wild things, from, you know, hubris to, you know, I've heard, oh, homosexuality to, you know, living in excess. But this is something you talk about in your book. Can you go into that a bit?
Yeah, well, one of the things we see there, I mean, there's probably the Maya collapse and the collapse of the Western Roman Empire are probably the two most discussed collapses in history that you know, that we engage in these conversations. And in talking and researching, talking to archaeologists and researching the collapse of the Roman Empire, a couple of things became apparent. One was that it was a very slow, gradual decline that took several centuries. And in fact, a lot of people, you know, will talk about it as this decline and not as a collapse because of the slow speed of it. The other thing that's pretty clear is that all of these causes that people cite are to some degree interrelated, and also that it doesn't play out the same in every part of the empire. In my book, you know, I have a quote from one of the administrators on the edge of the empire, suggesting that the regular folks in the area really don't even know who the emperor is at this point. And it really doesn't matter. And one of the things that we see is that as things change, and they change politically, and they might look like radical changes to us from a distance or from an archaeological point of view, sometimes for the regular person, the change was just not dramatic in the same way, or it was dramatic but in a different way. It, you know, it involves finding someone new, to perform certain functions that previously the empire did. And so if I were to look at the Roman Empire and the decline there, I think the thing I learned is that it really is just multi-causal and complex and slow and not homogeneous across the area.
Yeah. Curious about this, Chris. Why does the association between preppers and conservative thought exist, and how much does gun culture play a part in all of this?
Well, I talk about that in my book as well, and I've wondered if it could be a relationship between the culture that has developed among first responders and military and folks that might be thinking about things like disaster preparedness, which obviously would be sort of a fundamental part of preparing for something in the future. I think the other thing is that part of what happens with any of this stuff is that it gets, maybe we could, you know, say appropriated by one side or a group that has access to media and is able to promote their vision of this sort of stuff. So when I look now at the Survival or the Prepper magazines, you know, there's a couple of examples that are pretty much wilderness skill focused type of thing, living off the grid stuff, but a lot of them are combined with gun culture. And part of that obviously has to do with our image that a big part of what would happen if things collapsed is that violence would be out of control and we would need to defend ourselves. And so I think that in some ways there's this natural fit, but I also suspect that you'll find people that would not fit that description, who are part of this culture that just might be less represented in the visible, the literature and that sort of thing.
Sure, exactly.
You know, I'm curious, Chris, as I hear you talk, I'm wondering if, you know, really to create more resilience if we have this, you know, incremental decline of a society, we might be better served individually to learn about how to protect ourselves in a technological way from hackers and things like that than, you know, learning survival skills out there, that might be more of a practical thing, because we talk to people all the time who talk about, you know, cybersecurity and lack thereof, and, you know, we hear these stories about, you know, entire gas lines being shut down and different events like this that you go, wow, that's when I start to, you know, get into dramatic thinking about apocalypse or about the decline of a certain, you know, civilization.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there, just like now, just like any point in history, there's some need for protection of all sort. But one of the things that occurs to me is exactly the kind of thing that you're talking about. Not only protecting these systems we have, but think of how isolated and sort of localized places where some of this knowledge is stored or people that have it are located. So, for instance, let's just take agricultural knowledge. In some places, 50% or more of the population are involved in agriculture in the United States. You know, you're looking at the low single digits of people involved directly in agriculture. And so and these tend to be concentrated in certain parts of the country, and they're concentrated among certain groups. For instance, African-American farmers are really, really underrepresented now, or African-Americans are underrepresented as farmers now, even from what you saw 100 years ago. And so what we see then is that, in my opinion, we have the potential to lose a lot of knowledge if we have something that happens that makes the kind of interconnectivity we have now less available to us. So part of the survival strategy I would think about as a community would be to make sure we really spread out this knowledge, that we let a lot of different people from a lot of different places participate, so that you don't have all your eggs in one basket.
You know, it's interesting, and we only have about a minute left before we have to let you go, but we talked earlier about the supply chain, and the supply chain is efficient. We marvel at the just-in-time. We marvel at the way all the different pieces work together. And what we found out was it's not very resilient. It's actually kind of fragile. And a chip, for an example, when you take a computer chip and it's in your iPhone, let's say, for an example, that chip, starting with silicon, probably had to go to four or five different countries, and all these different things had to happen before it got to your phone. So it surprises me that we never thought about this before, about how fragile the whole thing is. But anyway, just a thought. But we want to thank you for joining us this morning, Chris Bagley, and he has written The Next Apocalypse, The Art and Science of Survival. Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for talking with me.
Okay.
Interesting thoughts. This is a good book for, you know, those in our lives that may be missing the point a little bit about apocalypse, or maybe they're over dramatizing.
Yeah.
Have any of those people in your life?
I think so.